This is Law and Disorder.
Today we bring listeners a Law and Disorder special titled The First 100 Days, Dismantling the Police State in a New Presidency. In it, we'll bring you a series of interviews with key attorneys, authors, and activists from the front lines, such as the Center for Constitutional Rights, Universities of Law, and the National Lawyers Guild. We define the current laws in place that now constitute a police state. Then we look at the steps the Obama administration must take to turn back the major breaches in civil liberties, such as the Patriot Act 1 and 2, the Military Commissions Act, FBI guidelines, and legal provisions that allow for torture. As you'll hear, some attorneys believe that much of the dismantling can be done by executive order. We begin with a description of what we have seen since September 11, 2001, and precursors, such as the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, the earlier renditions under Clinton's administration. Then, right after 9/11, came the overreaching of executive power in the form of signing statements that misused the War Powers Resolution to detain, torture, and try so-called enemy combatants. This includes racial profiling against Muslims here and abroad, massive surveillance capacities, and warrantless wiretapping. The dismantling of police state blocks in the new presidency will take attention to detail to ensure a full restoration of democracy that will ultimately allow for social progress. In the next few hours, we look at some remedies and solutions to reverse laws that have created domestic enemy combatants, Guantanamo Bay prison, renditions, secret CIA sites, torture, kangaroo courts, special trials, FISA, domestic surveillance, and private military contractors. To start this special series, we begin by talking with Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Vincent Warren, on the overview of the abuse of preventive detention, torture, rendition, and state secrets. We discuss recent examples of deep surveillance on peaceful protesters and the unprecedented collusion between federal, state, and local law enforcement. Warren points out the importance of rolling back the police state measures put in place by the Bush administration, in that no president has ever given back the power a previous president has given him. Welcome, Vince, to Law and Disorder's First 100 Days.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
Vince, what are your hopes for the first 100 days?
Well, you know, everyone is looking forward to this next administration. Who could not after the last 8 years of lawlessness? But the president has an awesome, awesome task at hand. In addition to the economy, in addition to the war, there are a range of civil liberties issues that absolutely must be addressed by this next president in the first 100 days.
What's at the top of your list?
At the top of the list, there is ending torture, the rendition program, and illegal detention. The torture program that the Bush administration has orchestrated has been close to unprecedented in U.S. history with respect to the global nature of it, the fact that it occurred both with respect to CIA black sites that happened that occurred in other countries in terms of detention facilities in Iraq and Afghanistan and even at home at Guantanamo Bay. The Bush administration has left us with a legacy of torture. It is now, based on what the Bush administration has done and Congress has done, it is now, at this moment, unprosecutable for the torturous crimes that have happened. And it's up to the next president to, first and foremost, put prosecution back on the table for the crimes that have been committed. They must close Guantanamo and not just send the people there to places where they'll be detained, but they need to send them to safety, repatriate them to countries where they came from, and if they can't go back safely, to find countries in order for them to be released safely.
People are looking to the next administration to push for prosecution. But what are the chances of that?
If there are subsequent civil proceedings, like the civil proceedings that the Center for Constitutional Rights is doing, the Center for Constitutional Rights, since shortly after September 11th, has filed a series of cases on a whole range of issues, over hundreds of Guantanamo detainees in habeas corpus petitions. We have cases involving extraordinary rendition, one involving Maeve Herr-Arar, the Canadian citizen that was sent to Syria to be tortured for 10 months. We have civil cases for the men in Guantanamo, not just habeas corpus cases, warrantless wiretapping cases, a whole range of cases in which we are calling on the government to, number one, come clean about what they did, to release documents and to put before a court information about the illegal practices, and number two, we're trying to hold them accountable in the context of civil proceedings, which means that they don't go to jail, but we're asking for relief like declaring what they did unconstitutional and illegal and against international law, asking for damages with respect to money, with respect to some of the clients that we represent, injunctive relief, which means to as a future deterrent to make sure that this type of thing doesn't happen again. But those cases, if President Bush were to grant pardons for the high-level officials like George Tenet and Donald Rumsfeld and other folks, they would not necessarily be able to avoid testimony because they don't have a fear of prosecution. So it might actually encourage them to come clean about what they did. But the other piece that you're saying is absolutely right. From the universal jurisdiction perspective, and the center has filed a series of cases, two in Germany, one in France, trying to hold Donald Rumsfeld and his cronies accountable, that those cases are strengthened when we say to foreign jurisdictions, you must take on this case and do criminal prosecution because we've tried every avenue in the United States and no one's doing anything.
Explain what universal jurisdiction is.
Universal jurisdiction is a very, very interesting principle that the center has been very deeply involved in for a number of years. And it stems from the Nuremberg principles, which say that a crime that is committed against a person anywhere is prosecutable essentially anywhere, and that the various countries like Spain and Germany and France have statutes that allow for human rights victims and survivors to bring cases for prosecution of, for example, U.S. government officials in countries outside of the U.S. For some people, they think that it's a tremendous stretch, but it is really the core net of what we're doing and what we're all trying to do, which is to hold people accountable. And you can't let these guys decide to run to different countries in order to avoid prosecution, because we've seen that over the last 50 years in a myriad of ways, and we have to stop it immediately.
Let's go back to the 100 days, Vince. One area, of course, is torture, rendition, secret sites, and it's both accountability going forward as well as stopping and ending all of that immediately. What other areas do you want to see changed in the first 100 days?
Well, there's another very important legal doctrine that a lot of people don't know about, but it is absolutely key to accountability, and that's the state secrets privilege, the privilege that the government has routinely invoked in a range of our cases that essentially say, as you file this case, plaintiff, for all the terrible things that we've done, we're not going to turn over any information to the court to let the court assess whether what we've done is illegal or not, because we're going to invoke a special secretness of this information. So we're not going to even show it to the court. And the courts are complicit and involved in this as well, because the courts should be evaluating the nature of the secrecy versus the need for accountability and for transparency. But what the courts have been doing is every time that the government has said state secrets, including the Supreme Court, they've essentially kicked the case. So you can't even get into court to find out what the government did to you, because the government says we're not going to tell you because of state secrets. That has to be immediately removed.
What's our remedy? I mean, I think what I've seen happen, of course, is rather than take state secrets for a particular piece of information, they may take it for a particular piece, but then the judge dismisses the entire case. And of course, they take it on information that shouldn't be state secrets. But is our remedy going to be in the court? Is it going to be in Congress? Is it going to be with the president? What is it?
Well, the remedy is really in all three. And I think that you're right, Michael. I think the remedy with respect to the president is that the president is involved and oversees the executive branch within which the Department of Justice falls. And so the president has some say with respect to who he picks as the attorney general, who runs the Department of Justice. And the Department of Justice can come clean and not invoke the state secrets privilege in the context of their litigation. So that's something that the president can do. Congress, by statute, in their legislative power, can create a statute that limits the use of the state secrets privilege in order to make it consistent with truth-telling and accountability, which, you know, would satisfy the government's need for some level of secrecy. It's an issue I don't necessarily agree with, but certainly would allow for heinous violations to be heard in open court. And with respect to the courts have got it completely wrong, Michael. Every time the government waves the state secrets flag, they kick the case. They don't have to do it. They don't need to do it. It's politically motivated, and we need judges that are willing to stand up to this government and bring these issues to light.
Okay, so we have the torture rendition issues. We have the state secret issues. What else are you looking forward if you had your perfect 100 days, Vince?
What is of grave concern to all of us is, and it's become very clear with respect to the Republican National Convention in particular, is the right to dissent. It is not overstating it to say that the right to dissent has equaled terrorism with respect to how George Bush and his cronies see it. We have to remember that no president has ever given back authority that the previous presidents have given him. So what we now have is the next administration is looking at a scenario in which the government employs deep surveillance, preventive detention, infiltration of legitimate First Amendment-based political movements as a way to suppress dissent. And quite literally that they go in, and we saw this in St. Paul, and you know the National Lawyers Guild, as Heidi knows, has been absolutely all over this, that they went in and they did sweeps of houses where they thought that that activists were, and they arrested people, they took their laptops, they took their cell phones, and they confiscated all of this information before anyone even had an ability to protest. By the time it was done, that these protesters were denied their core First Amendment rights, their Fourth Amendment rights were completely violated, and I think the really important piece is that they targeted journalists and they targeted people who were going to monitor these things, and it limited the ability for us who weren't there to know exactly what happened because the government came in and basically took out the cameras. And in addition, I think that, you know, there are other issues that are extremely important. And, you know, we'll be coming out, the Center for Constitutional Rights is going to be coming out with a series of white papers on some of these issues. One thing that really dovetails with what I just talked about is the abuse of preventive detention. And preventive detention is something that I think is coming, and we at the Center are very, very fearful about. And what that essentially is that the Constitution requires the government to detain people based upon a belief that a crime is being committed or is about to be committed. What preventive detention does is it really puts that on its head, and they say, you know what, we think you're going to commit a crime, or you might commit a crime, or we think that you're generally dangerous, so we're going to detain you before we have any information that we're going to use in order to keep you in jail. That is patently illegal. It is extremely problematic. And I think as we see success in the Guantanamo context, I think that we would be looking at Congress very closely because they will very likely be pushing some of these things forward.
Vince, is the center concerned about fusion centers and the secrecy involved with fusion centers and the premise basically following what you just said of sort of preemptive law enforcement? Fusion centers are, and there are at least 40 in existence, it's the government's attempt to centralize coordination between different levels of law enforcement, essentially to share information, data mining, and intelligence gathering. But there's a concern that there's no set standards across the board and no one can monitor because a lot of what they're doing is done, again, in secrecy.
That's right. And I think, you know, the irony here is that in all contexts of government action, one hand of the government doesn't know what the other hand of the government is doing unless they're coming down firmly on our constitutional rights. Then all of a sudden, everybody is on the same page. It's extremely important, and we're very concerned about it. And I think that for the two issues that you raised, one is because there is an unprecedented collusion, which is the word that I would use, between the federal and the state branches and amongst federal branches of the executive to collect and share information. As we know, that as the data is mined, as they require more identification for everything, that information doesn't go away and it begins to go into central databases that are shared amongst the federal agencies. Then the federal agencies work in collusion with the state agencies and basically direct, orchestrate state agency actions to come down very hard. The other piece of it that you raised, Heidi, which is extremely important, is that there is no oversight. This is happening in largely in secret. The only way that we're finding out about this is through independent media and through people that have been doing litigation on some of these issues longstanding, going back to other protests. It's extremely important that we begin to focus on this moving forward.
Vince, talk about the authorization to use military force that Congress passed a week after 9/11, and then 2 months after that, Bush's military order number one. Those are still in play. I imagine they're going to be in play after the election. And how does that impact upon our democratic rights?
Well, it impacts on the democratic rights next week the same way that it impacted in November and October when these issues came out, which is that these orders that you talked about, one that came from Congress and one that came from the president, essentially shifted the balance and the burdens in the government and gave unprecedented power to the president to take whatever actions he deemed necessary to, quote unquote, make us safe, which essentially, from their perspective, meant capturing, killing, and detaining, quote unquote, terrorists. But what has happened is, if you look at the number of quote-unquote terrorists that have been captured and detained, certainly in the United States context, is that it's virtually zero. What the captives in this war have been U.S. citizens, people who have been doing political protest, essentially the Constitution itself. If we have a situation where we have taken the presidency outside of the constitutional box, which I would submit that those two orders did, our charge with this next president, and frankly beyond the next president, is how do we put the presidency back in the box again? I think that going forward would, even with the best of intentions, no matter what they're saying, would only get us close to a third of the way to put this Constitution back together again. And the other two-thirds really comes from us. We're the people that are going to be looking at this agenda that we're talking about now for the 100 days and forcing the next administration to do something about it. They're going to be sidetracked with the legitimate issues of the economy. They're going to be going back and forth over timetables for withdrawal from Iraq. They need to pull those troops out, by the way, and stop, you know, monkeying around with the political timetables and things like that. But these are core fundamental issues that have altered the landscape, the constitutional and civil liberties landscape of this country, and it will be impenetrable if we don't do something about it immediately.
Well, that's what concerns us, of course. Without democratic rights, you can't have any progressive social change, and it seems that they've tried to foreclose that, you know, going back 5 years after 9/11.
Vince, we want to wrap up really on what we would like this administration, at least in terms of civil liberties, human rights, to do in the first 100 days. And you've given us a number of really important thoughts and a push that has to go. Are there some other things that we should be focusing on in terms of changing the scenario?
A very important component to this, which really should not be lost in all of the political back and forth about withdrawing troops from Iraq, but recent revelations of about how the UN is U.S. is has its eye on Iran, and that the invasion of Syria recently, I think, needs to bring us back to this fundamental question, which was that the war in Iraq was fundamentally illegal. And that really can't be lost on people as we move this forward. So we're going to be coming out with a white paper that is talking about the restoration of the War Powers Act. And we're going to be calling for ending the occupation in Iraq and abuses of the authorization for the use of military force that Michael was talking about. And a real pledge to abide by the War Powers Act and the restrictions that it places on the United States in order to wage war unilaterally.
This war issue has certainly been the hardest issue that I think we've struggled with both at the center and in this country. I mean, this country has really, since I've been a lawyer, which started in the Vietnam War, has basically been at war my entire life, aggressive wars. And so I think that trying to put some restraint on that is crucial, but it's one in which we have not been very successful.
The last war where Congress declared war, which is what it's supposed to do according to our Constitution, was World War II.
The declaration doesn't bother me. They get enough votes to equivalent. They could have just said the word declare in this last case, for example. That's not what really gets me. What gets me is we haven't been able to slow the dogs of war. And for a short period when Jimmy Carter was in office, because it was right after Vietnam, 76 to 80, there was some slowing of war, and that was because we'd been so burned by Vietnam. But we're back at really full throttle now, if not worse. So I just think it's an important thing that I'm really glad the center is continuing. This war issue is crucial.
Back in the 70s when Senator Church had the Church Commission that stemmed in large part from the illegal wiretapping activities of the Nixon administration, and shortly after CCR's founder Arthur Kanoy argued a wiretapping case successfully in the Supreme Court, U.S. versus U.S. District Court, Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which, among other things, created a secret court which the federal government could go to get wiretaps for national security type issues. And back back in 1978, there was outrage that we would have a secret court in the United States. Since George Bush came along and decided to tell the National Security Agency that they didn't even have to go to the secret court, we pined for the days when we actually had a president that would go to the secret court that we didn't want to have in place to begin with. But moving forward, this is a very key issue for the next president, because it really strikes at the heart of the security question. And, you know, our position is that that security questions pale, and pale by far, in comparison to the rampant abuse of cherished Fourth and First Amendment rights that we have. And we cannot live in a society in which any president could even entertain for a moment secret wiretapping of its citizens, whether it's its citizens domestically or its citizens living abroad or its citizens talking to foreign nationals. It is completely unacceptable. And if we give this up, we have given up the entire fight. So that is really an important piece. And then finally, we want to cap our discussion of the first 100 days piece with talking about the a rollback of executive power, which really encompasses all of the things that we've talked about. And I know that Michael Smith cares very, very deeply about this. But quite honestly, we have created a monster in the next president by trying to doing our work with respect to this president. It is absolutely imperative. And if anything, anybody hears anything that I've said, it is that the next president must be accountable to the people. Arthur Quinoy, my law professor and in some ways mentor, would say to us in law school that there really are four branches of government, and the fourth branch is the people. And the people have been largely missing from this calculus. So the Center for Constitutional Rights has focused on the legislative branch. We've focused on the judicial branch. We've sued the hell out of the executive branch. And we're going to be counting on the people to help us, the fourth branch of government, with this next president, because he must be accountable to us.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for being at the center and for really taking us into our first 100 days.
I really enjoyed being here with you all, and thank you so much for doing this tremendous show. It's really, really great and extremely important.
Thank you, Vince.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
For long years, I'm flying home.
We're really pleased to be joined by author and activist Naomi Wolf. Naomi is the author of 7 books, including the groundbreaking book, The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. In the book, Naomi addresses 10 steps that societies, dictators, and sometimes democracies use to close an open society and move it toward fascism. Today, we will revisit those 10 steps. Here they are. First, invoke a terrifying internal and external enemy. Second, create a gulag. Third, develop a thug caste. Fourth, set up an internal surveillance system. Fifth, harass citizens groups. Sixth, engage in arbitrary detention and release. Seventh, target key individuals. Eighth, control the press. Ninth, equate dissent with treason. And 10th, suspend the rule of law. I'm sure each of us can fit the facts of the last 8 years into those 10 steps. Here is Naomi to give us her perspective on why she chose those 10 steps and what they mean in today's society.
Welcome back, Naomi.
Thank you, Heidi. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, we're excited because you've had so many wonderful new developments since we last talked. You have Give Me Liberty, the book that's come out recently, and The End of America, your film.
That's right.
Your first book on this theme of really sort of a post-9/11 what's happening in America was called The End of America.
That's right.
And what it did is, and I remember saying that to you, is it really set out for a broader audience than we reach what you saw occurring in America. And you had this sort of 10 principles or 10 steps. And why don't you just give us a summary of that book? It became a bestseller. Mm-hmm. And then from that emerged the movie and mm-hmm. then this amazing handbook. So just talk about your thesis a little bit, Naomi.
Sure, I will. Just before I talk about the 10 steps, I want to say that while it's reached a lot of people, I could never have written it without help from you, Michael, and the Center for Constitutional Rights, and you guys at the National Lawyers Guild, Heidi, you and Marjorie, because I've been very, very lucky, and I think every American should have the opportunity, which is why I'm engaged in this work right now, of having the best of the best, meaning people like you and Marjorie and Michael, explain to me what the law is and what's at stake and what's going on in terms of the subversion of liberties. Because one real problem we have in America is that we need to defend liberty, but over the last 30 years or more and more of the tools we need in order to do so have been kind of aggregated by the powers that be out of the hands of citizens. And if you're not a lawyer, it's very hard to, you know, follow a lot of the developments anyway. So one of the things I'm trying to do is popularize the work that you all are doing so heroically in the front lines. So what's the thesis? And by the way, don't just send WBAI money. You've got to send the National Lawyers Guild and the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU money as well, because they're our army. They're our generals in the front lines in this war against citizens. Okay, so, and by the way, last pitch, whatever you're thinking about buying for Christmas or Hanukkah, there is no greater gift you can give than a donation to someone you love in their name to the NLG, CCR, ACLU, or WBAI, because there's no greater gift than the gift of liberty.
And wrap that in a copy of Give Me Liberty.
There you go.
Naomi's handbook, which is really, it's great for even movement people who think they know how to organize. I mean, we'll get to that book, but it's a very, very critical book.
Thank you, Michael. So the thesis of End of America, which I wrote last year, 2007, the beginning of it, you know, of the journey of thinking I did, was brought about by a friend of mine, Wendy Yeager-Hyman, who is the daughter of Holocaust survivors. And you and I have talked about this, Michael. She kept insisting that some of the themes and strategies we were seeing in the Bush years had happened in Germany in the early years of the 30s. And at first I thought that this was insanely extreme and I disregarded it. But she insisted that I read some history. And when I started actually reading the history, not of the later years, which we're all familiar with, 38, 39, 40, but the early years, 1930, 31, 32, when Germany was a parliamentary democracy with many political parties and many newspapers and human rights lawyers and celebrities and gay rights organizations, you know, a modern pluralistic state, though a fragile one, I saw what she was talking about, because a small group of people used the law to subvert the law. And there were so many parallels with tactics and strategies that I saw, everything from the way in the early 30s, the National Socialists, who are a minority party, used what historians now think is a hyped or trumped up terrorist attack on the parliament to intimidate parliamentarians into passing legislation that's very much like the Patriot Act, all the way to insisting that they disembowel their own constitution, give away their own powers to an increasingly strong executive or leader, which ushered in, you know, everything to come, and actual tactics and strategies, actual laws I saw reproduced. I mean, Clause 2 in the Enabling Acts.
The Enabling Acts in Germany.
In Germany, thank you, gave the state the power to read German citizens' mail and listen into their phone calls and open their telegrams, again in the alleged interest of national security and the fight against terrorism.
Homeland security. They actually called it homeland security.
Exactly. There are so many things like this that jump off the pages. Heimat, homeland. You know, little things that are kind of creepily small but identical. The Nazis used to unload the coffins of the war dead at night, and we started to unload the coffins of the war dead at night. You look at Leni Riefenstahl's propaganda documentary, Triumph of the Will, and you see the Fuhrer descending in this plane and greeted by these uniformed masses, and he says, our mission must be accomplished, and then you compare that with, you know, the famous scene on the aircraft carrier, Mission Accomplished. And much more, you know, disturbing things like, I, as a Jew, you know, you kind of have this kind of, I think, collective memory about things that are familiar. And I remember reading about Dixie Chicks CDs being burned all over the South because the Dixie Chicks had said something critical of Bush. And Clear Channel, which has close ties to the White House, had sponsored or supported these spontaneous CD burnings. And I'm thinking, well, that's weird. CDs don't burn. You know, I was also thinking, like, where have I heard that before? Right. Well, of course, Goebbels in 1933 sponsored, quote unquote, spontaneous book burnings of books critical of the regime. So there were so many echoes. And then I read other accounts of other times and places where a would-be dictator, whether on the left or on the right, sought to close an open society or crush a democracy movement. So I looked at Mussolini in 1920, and he was the great evil pioneer of these strategies. And, of course, I looked at the Germans. Hitler studied Mussolini. Stalin studied Hitler. Hitler studied Stalin. They learned from one another. I looked at Stalin's Russia. Then I looked at East Germany in the 50s, Czechoslovakia in the 60s, Pinochet's coup in Chile in 73, the Chinese crackdown on the democracy movement in the 80s. And what I saw is that there is a blueprint. The blueprint has 10 steps, 10 classic steps, no matter whether you're on the left or the right, a fascist or a totalitarian. If you want to be a dictator, you always use these 10 steps. The 10 steps have been codified. They teach them at the School for the Americas here, you know, to help Latin American would-be dictators overthrow their own governments and torture their own citizens. And these 10 steps always work. It turns out to be quite simple to close down a democracy. It's quite difficult to sustain a democracy. And what really terrified me is that I had to face the fact that those 10 steps were being put in place by the Bush administration. So that is the thesis of End of America.
I'm sure you get attacked, or you have been probably, for saying, well, this isn't Germany in the 30s and the 40s. That was massive murder, killing, etc. But what you're really saying is that the way you closed down a democracy are these steps, and these are echoes of what happened in Germany and these other countries.
Yes, although I have to say I was attacked a lot less than I expected because the evidence is so chilling when you look at these things side by side. Michael, it's for exactly that reason, I hope you'll appreciate this as a lawyer, that the rhetorical strategy I used in the book is very conservative, lowercase c, in the sense that I simply put the parallels side by side and let the reader conclude for him or herself.
Naomi, one of the things that we've been really impressed with is that in addition to the extensive research you conducted, you've been traveling around the country and speaking to Americans. And had that informed the work that you've done?
Well, you know, I spend a lot of time traveling and speaking to Americans for, you know, generally as part of my job. I knew the kind of danger Americans were in from doing the research that led me to these conclusions, and I knew from my knowledge of talking to people from all different backgrounds and walks of life that we were in greater danger because Americans aren't familiar with those signs. People all over the world, like I would talk to journalists in Latin America after I wrote an early article summarizing these 10 steps, and journalists in Argentina or Brazil know perfectly well the difference between publishing a newspaper in a closed society and publishing it in an open society. Same newspaper, right? But you know how far you're allowed to go. And what worried me about America and why I felt like I had to get out there, like, you know, really sound the alarm, is that Americans have been, until recently, quite naive about feeling protected by this bubble of democracy. They had, when I first began writing, I think that's changed now, Americans had a sense of, well, democracy will protect me, but I don't have to lift a finger to protect democracy. Or they had a sense of, it can't happen here. So all over the world, people in the developing world or people who had experienced dictatorship or real oppression would look at American legislation and go, oh my God, you're making it easier for your leader to declare martial law? Oh my God, you're okaying wiretapping of citizens. Don't you know what this leads to? And Americans were blithely like, well, it's, you know, it's done in the name of the war on terror. It, you know, if I have nothing to hide, you know, I can't get in trouble. Totally naive.
I think what is extraordinary, and then we'll get to the 10 steps.
Well, we've just said two of them.
Two of them. Right. But when I see you go out there and talk to people, is, as Heidi said, you really went out to people. I mean, people who are just regular people, yeah, who you gave this message to. And I, if anybody ever gets a chance to see you, they should go, because it's a mesmerizing inclusion. And people are sitting there. You look at the audience and they're just stunned by what you're saying. And so it's something that a lot of people don't do, and that you did it even before you wrote the book to get a sense of what was going on is quite remarkable.
Thank you. But just to update my experience with my fellow Americans on the road, after I wrote The End of America and after it came out again, I was expecting a lot of hostility or skepticism, but was so moving to me, Michael. You know, we're in a bubble here in New York or on both coasts, just like people are in a bubble in red states, people are in a bubble in their own communities. And that divide and conquer thing, I talk about it in Give Me Liberty, we're very much divided from each other and we have stereotypes about each other. I was very moved on the road with Give Me Liberty to speak to audiences like I've never met before, in the sense of I'd be speaking to 800 or 1,200 people, you know, not just the usual crunchy granola Smith graduates who are my base, you know, but, you know, truckers, farmers, libertarians, evangelicals, conservatives, you know, middle class people, upper middle class people, working people, truly from all demographics, all of whom were there because they love liberty and they love the Constitution and because they're sensible enough to understand that there's something scary going on and to recognize putting the pieces together when they hear it. So I was very moved by how transpartisan this issue is. And it's also inspiring because I got a sense from the diversity of those audiences and the love that people across party lines have for the Constitution when these issues are explained clearly. I was hopeful that we can really create a transpartisan mass movement of citizens to restore our liberties. So thank you.
Let's run through, because we have your second book to get to, Give Me Liberty, and we have the film. Let's
what are the
run
10
through
steps?
The 10 steps.
They're so scary. So the first is that if you want to close an open society, you always invoke a terrifying internal and external threat, and sometimes it can be a real threat. Many of the initial charges against people accused with great fanfare by the Justice Department in the early days of the quote-unquote war on terror evaporate, you know, once they get to a real courtroom. But there are no headlines about those.
No, that's what happened. I mean, we had the real threat.
Right.
And then we charged a whole mass of people, and a lot of those people never even went to trial. And
exactly.
It's still going on.
And it's still going on. We had this terrorist attack, and that's a real attack. But the government chose to hype and manipulate fear for its own reasons. And it's not necessary. If you look at Spain, for instance, a country that was also hit by a very bad terrorist attack, the same bad guys, they didn't react by terrifying their own citizens and stripping them of civil liberties. In fact, they tried those accused in
the regular,
regular courts and put the transcripts on the internet, these transcripts that are so dangerous that none of us, not even our journalists or our, you know, lawyers can see what they're going to be saying. You know, and you look at Pinochet, he hyped a real threat. There were armed insurgents, but then he created false documents to hype that threat. And again, this administration created false documents in the form of the yellow cake documents to terrify us into a false charge that we had to invade Iraq because they were allegedly getting uranium to build a nuclear bomb. That's scary stuff. The second thing you do is that you create a, and this is your bailiwick, all of you, you create a prison system outside the rule of law where torture takes place. And the state starts to legitimize torture. Many Americans didn't feel upset or personally distraught at first that there was this island, Guantanamo Bay, where the administration was claiming that it was outside the rule of law and that anything could be done to these people because they really felt like this was the other. But the study of history shows how dangerous that is, because always what happens is a would-be dictator starts by torturing or abusing people who are seen as at the margins of civil society. In Germany, they started, torture was illegal when the SA started to grab people and take them to these makeshift torture cellars. But who did they start with? Anarchists, communists. And people were like, whatever. You know, they knew about it. But then they moved on to closer and closer to the heart of civil society, homosexuals, Jews. People were still like, I don't care. It's the other. But then there was this one month in April of 1933 when the SA rounded up people at the heart of civil society. And it's always the same cast of characters at this stage. Opposition leaders, labor leaders, outspoken clergy, and journalists and editors. And once that happened, civil society structures were still in place, but everyone went silent. And you see that step again and again once torture is legalized. And a challenge I put to my audiences is, and maybe you guys have an answer, but no one else has yet, can you name a state that has legalized torture that did not sooner or later use it against its own citizens? The third thing you do is you create a paramilitary force not answerable to the people. In Italy, these were black shirts. In Germany, brown shirts.
You're about to say it, but when I read your book, The End of America, I thought this was one of your best perceptions. Because I sat there thinking about some of this stuff when I visited Germany for various cases, and I said, well, it's different because we don't have black shirts, we don't have brown shirts. And your answer was?
Blackwater, unfortunately.
Exactly.
Eric Prince, the CEO, has close ties to the Bush White House, and he handpicks mercenaries who were torturers and murderers in their own countries, in countries that do torture and murder their own civilians, Chileans, Nigerians, you know, Pinochet's guys.
And then you coupled that, as I recall, with saying, you know, some people say, well, that's overseas, don't worry about it. But your point is, overseas will happen in America.
It's happening in America, in that case,
in the case of Blackwater, you point to New Orleans.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, Jeremy Scahill reported this very fully. Blackwater contractors were deployed in New Orleans in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, and there are reports of contractors shooting unarmed civilians. Now, Blackwater's business plan calls for increased deployment in the United States. They've got a base now in Illinois. They're trying to open a base in San Diego, and their website calls for monitoring, overseeing, engaging in, controlling populations in Midtown Manhattan. So it's very scary, and if that wasn't scary enough, since I wrote the book, the 1st Brigade has been redeployed from Iraq to somewhere in the United States of America, 3,000 to 4,000 battle-hardened warriors in violation of Posse Comitatus and the Insurrection Act. And, you know, the day after Obama was elected, two more brigades were redeployed. And as I understand it, nothing prevents the executive from redeploying 10 brigades or 20 brigades. Very terrifying. We'll get to that. It's part of step 10. The fourth thing you do is create a surveillance apparatus aimed at ordinary citizens. That freaked me out in particular because I found myself on the watch list when I flew for a year and a half. Every time I flew the quadruple S, and many, many critics of the administration were getting the quadruple S. And unfortunately, the guy who wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins, who knows this world, he told me to talk about this in public, but my mail started arriving opened, ripped right open, and my tax returns, registered mail, disappeared from my mailbox. And, you know, other important documents disappeared. My daughter's letters, all her letters from camp, vanished. This sounds paranoid and crazy, but I've talked to other activists like Mark Crispin Miller, who documented vote fraud. He also experienced mail tampering. It's not like American doesn't have a history of this kind of harassment. Do I know who did it? No, I don't. I have no evidence at all. But the post office said this is not possible. So that's a tangent. But many activists are reporting, you know, MoveOn assumes that all their emails are read, all their phone calls are listened to. Lawyers are being eavesdropped on.
At the center, we have a lawsuit because all our lawyers who are in contact with, quote, alleged terrorist families in Europe and Pakistan and Middle East, they're all wiretapped. There's no doubt. It's 100%.
Which is horrific. Right. And it's not just, I don't think it's just the issue of the content. It's the way it affects you. I find that it has a really corrosive effect.
Oh, sure.
Personally.
Our lawyers have to fly to the Middle East to have a conference with a family member because they can't trust the phone lines or the email.
Unbelievable.
So that's what happens.
Unbelievable. The fifth is that you see arbitrary detention and release of citizens, like James Yee, the Guantanamo chaplain. The sixth step is that you start to see infiltration and harassment of citizens' groups, like the kind of infiltration.
I want to stay on that one for a moment. The infiltration one is interesting because what's happened, as we've seen post 9/11 is we had FBI guidelines that restricted the FBI that were heavily fought for during the 70s and the 80s and even into the 90s. And then the first thing that happened when Ashcroft took office, he started to modify them. He took away the criminal predicate so you could go and do it without a criminal predicate. And then what they've done recently, and they've done it with regard to informants and infiltration, a few weeks ago, they said on new Bush guidelines that you could use race and ethnicity, essentially, to begin an investigation, and you could put informants into any group you wanted.
And this is profound because, you know, we saw in East Germany, everyone assumed they had a Stasi file, a secret police file, you know, reported by infiltrators. And so everyone monitored their actions and didn't trust each other, which is one way you really break down the kind of affiliation building that goes to a vigorous democracy. Right. When the wall came down, it turned out only 10% of the population actually had a Stasi file. But all you need to know is that you can be watched or infiltrated to act like you will. And the really scary thing about the legislation, the guidelines that you just described, is to me is that I think that it makes it okay for people to act like your friend or act like someone who sincerely cares about you on a personal level, get to know you intimately, and report back to headquarters.
Even if you don't have – it's interesting. You can do that. It's called a false friend. Even if you don't have any evidence of criminality, and you can do it based on, you know, anything you want, essentially, on your website or your books or anything.
So disturbing. The seventh step is that you start to see individuals being targeted for penalties like career setbacks or smears for criticizing the regime. People like Valerie Plame loses her job. Dan Rather loses his job for a critical report.
Those are both very good examples, actually.
Yeah. The eighth step is you start to see restrictions of the press. Things like Josh Wolf, no relation, a blogger in San Francisco who was in federal prison for 7 months.
We interviewed him on this show. He's a heroic kid.
Isn't he great?
Oh, my God. Remember that? Yeah. The videotape. you had him in the movie
In
also,
the movie,
right?
Yeah. Okay. He's a wonderful presence and a real inspiration. The ninth thing you start to see is increasing, you know, language and legislation that recasts criticism as espionage and dissent as treason. So you start to see verbal charges like, you know, if you criticize the war, Hillary Clinton is committing treason or Obama is committing treason. But you start to actually see legislation like H.R. 1955, which thankfully hasn't passed the Senate yet, as I understand, but is terrifying. If you get what it's really saying, it's modeled, I think, on Nazi law because they had very similar legislation increasingly criminalizing speech and thought. And as I often tell my audiences, H.R. 1955 is so loosely worded that it would make listening to this broadcast an offense or engaging in this broadcast.
And we've
offense.
Looked at that. I always forget the name. It's like called the Violent Radicalization Act or something like that. And it really is it's an act about thought and speech.
Yes, it is.
And it's setting up these commissions around the country that are then going to look into where there's militant or radical speech. Right. It passed the House overwhelmingly, like 400-something to like 6. I mean,
which is one note of, I think, you know, while we're talking about these threats, I do like to see where there are victories. And I have to say, so many the mainstream media did not report on H.R. 1955 at all. But ordinary people alerted each other. And I think ordinary people screamed and yelled at their congresspeople. And I believe that that's held it back from becoming the law of the land. So when people wake up, there's a lot that, you know, they can do to stop these kinds of erosions. Then the last step is where we were at, you know, right before the election. And we're not backed off entirely from it now, and that is step 10, which is subverting the rule of law and making it easier to declare martial law. And that's when you start to see the way the White House was relating to Congress for the last 8 months or so, where Congress would, you know, present a law and the president would issue a signing statement, or Congress would say, we need to see those two destroyed tapes of Al-Zubaydah being waterboarded, that's evidence of a crime. And they would say, whatever, we're not going to give them to you. Or they would say, we're subpoenaing Josh Bolton and Harriet Myers. And Congress would say, and the White House would say, too bad.
The ultimate arrogance was when Cheney told Leahy to F you.
In so many words?
He used, I can't say it on the air, but we know what we're talking
about.
Right. And that was the executive telling the legislature and putting him in his place.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. And you saw this, it's a total replay. I think people very high up in the administration have studied fascism and totalitarianism. It's Condoleezza Rice's specialty. I think Karl Rove has a deep interest in the era. I have to say, as a matter of historical record, Prescott Bush, George Bush's grandfather, affiliated with the Nazis and was part of an attempted coup. This is actually fully documented in the 30s of industrial leaders who didn't like the New Deal and who admired what was happening in Italy and Germany and sent an agent over to learn about it and then tried to do the same thing in the U.S. It was thwarted by a war hero named Smedley Darlington Butler, and this is all in the congressional record. But I have no evidence that I have no smoking gun, but the echoes are extraordinary. In this case, you look at Italy in 1920, there were 6 months when the parliament kept acting like the parliament and Mussolini would just ignore them, you know, and ignore them and ignore them. And then there was the March on Rome. So the other scary developments in Step 10 are forms of legislation like the Defense Authorization Act of 2007 that lets the president say it's a national emergency. Just because he says so, it makes it one, you know, magical powers. And then deploy, well, at that time, he could deploy the National Guard from Alabama to New York over the objections of both governors to create martial law. And now he actually has his own military. And so just to conclude the full circle and then get to hopefully what we can do or what still needs to be done, what is absolutely terrifying to me, I think we all have our greatest fears in this list, and they're probably come from our personal experience. To me, I'm most scared of Blackwater when it was just Blackwater, and now I am absolutely terrified of the deployment of the military. That's one thing that I have gotten a lot of criticism for. It's interesting. Well, some of the mainstream media, like the Today Show, had me on just to rip me apart when I said I was concerned about the deployment of the 1st Brigade.
That's very odd because, you know, when I think about this, one of my arguments always is whatever we think of the cops, good and bad, and they violate the law a great deal, they're trained in constitutional rights. They're trained not to shoot first. They're trained to use the least excessive amount of force. Whether they always go there is another question. Mm-hmm. Military people, brigades, Blackwater, as we know and as we've seen, they're trained to shoot first. They're not trained in constitutional rights. That's not what it's about. So it's very dangerous to have the military in the U.S.
And also the police are accountable.
That's
exactly
true.
Corporal David Antoon, one of my sources, confirmed. I interviewed David Antoon. And because of my study of history, what am I scared of? The precedent historically is that always when the military is deployed domestically, they're deployed against voters and opposition leaders, especially in a closely fought election. And so my fear was, you know, NORTHCOM's initial stated mission was the 1st Brigade is here to, quote, subdue unruly individuals and engage in, quote, crowd control. Well, we were running right up to an election that we knew was going to be close with a lot of theft. And so my worry was voters show up, they're not on the rolls, they're upset, they're, quote, unruly individuals, they're agents provocateurs, because we know that agents get dressed like whatever, create situations of violence. And then the 1st Brigade is called in, or a declaration of martial law. I was sincerely scared about that. I said to Major Antoon, what happens if, and what people don't understand, and I didn't either, is the 1st Brigade isn't answerable to the people. They're not answerable to Congress. The National Guard are answerable to Congress or the governors. That's why we, you know, the founders had this beauty that, you know, a well-regulated militia is answerable to the people, because they knew what a standing army can do to a population from their own experience of King George's mercenaries, right, and King George's soldiers. So the 1st Brigade is President Bush's army, and now it's going to be Barack Obama's army and any president in the future. And I said, well, if the president says to the 1st Brigade, arrest those civilians, what happens? He says they have to do it. And I said, if he says shoot those civilians, what happens? He said they have to do it. And I said, and if other senior military say disobey those orders, what happens? He said they get arrested. And I said, well, if they tell the 1st Brigade to arrest Congress people, what happens? He said they have to do it. And this is a war hero. You know, this is a guy who fought and served, you know, his country and is a deep patriot. He said, the 1st Brigade can drive a tank down a street in Washington, D.C. and take out the Washington Times or the Washington Post with a shell and say that they were aiming at something else, like they did with Al Jazeera in Baghdad.
In the Palestinian Hotel.
And then I turn to you, Michael, because nobody believed me, right? And so I have to get validation or at least be told I'm wrong by the greatest minds in the land. So I said, Michael, the global war on terror rationale is that the whole world is a battlefield, right? Well, if the whole world is a battlefield, how is the U.S. not a battlefield? And if there's military on our soil, what prevails, military law or civilian law? And I wanted you to say that's a crazy question. And you didn't say that that was a crazy question. You said that those are the questions we need to ask.
No, those are the questions. And we think about this with some of our clients. Mahar Arar, the man who was sent to Syria, he got off the plane at Kennedy. The question you have to ask is, could, if there were military people at the airport, they thought he was Al-Qaeda, Could he have been shot on the spot as he got off the plane? Jose Padilla, when he got off the plane in Chicago, military people at the airport, so-called dirty bomber. Could he have been shot at the airport? And I can tell you this, if he had been shot by the military at the airport, I'm willing to bet it would have been the same justification.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.